Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Okay, so we're going to start this next conversation with a flashback to the 2014 Sochi Olympic Games. Women's hockey, US v Canada, gold medal game.
Good passing movement, Fortino. Surely a shot's going to come. It's there! Poulin's done it! Poulin has scored again! Poulin wins gold for Canada! Canada have done it! They've won their fourth consecutive gold medal!
And while it still might sting to relive that narrow loss for some here in the U.S., let's not forget that that game generated a lot of passion and enthusiasm for the sport of women's hockey. Nearly 5 million people watched some great hockey that day.
But that same enthusiasm is considerably dampened away from the Olympics. Consider this. Anthony, did you know that Boston actually has a professional women's ice hockey team?
I think I knew that, but don't ask me to tell you their name.
Okay, well, I too shall be perfectly honest and say that I didn't even know it. And neither did one of the team's own best players for a while. So the team is called the Boston Blades, and forward Megan Duggan, a two-time U.S. Olympian and former Women's Collegiate Player of the Year, barely knew the team existed until just before the Blades drafted her back in 2011. And these days, rather than playing televised matchups before an audience of millions, these same professional players play home games in Boston, where attendance registers at an anemic 250 fans per game.
And that's just one of the examples that led the Boston Globe's Shira Springer to wonder why fans ignore women's pro sports. The athletes are top-notch, and so are the games, but why aren't most women's leagues as successful as men's leagues?
Shira Springer wrote about it in this weekend's Boston Globe magazine. There's a link to her piece at radioboston.org, but she joins us now in the studio. Shira, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So your piece was great. I mean, there's so much to talk about why women's leagues and professional sports don't seem to be as successful as men. But I want you, actually, could we start with this example of ice hockey? Because you were in Sochi covering the Winter Olympics. Just remind us about what the attention and the excitement around the women's sports was then.
It was amazing. By far the best sporting event I witnessed at the 2014 Winter Olympics. It was exciting. The play was at a very, very high level. So high, in fact, that you had NHL players in the stands on their feet watching. I mean, this is not a lesser caliber of hockey. It's different than the men's game, but it was equally entertaining. There was a loud, raucous crowd, and as you said, 5 million viewers watching around the world, and deservedly so.
Yeah, and the media attention was there, and I mean, we were talking about the great players from New England who were on the team. So talk to me about what it was like when you came back from Sochi and sort of returned back down to reality when it comes to women's professional sports here.
Well, I'll have to admit, until I started doing some of my advanced coverage for the Olympics, I didn't even know that there was a women's pro hockey team in the Boston area. I was unfamiliar with the Boston Blades. It's amazing to me that the women who can draw the kinds of crowds that they do for the Olympics, and not only the kinds of crowds that they do, but there were rows, I would say the rows for the media greeting area where we interview the players was about 8 deep, and it was just packed. Easily over 100, 150 members of the media after the gold medal game. And to think that these women don't get any attention and barely any fans and have to do fundraisers and figure out ways to fund trips and draw fans into the audience. I mean, they are doing hockey clinics, and the agreement with the hockey clinics is if we do a hockey clinic for your team, you agree to buy 20 tickets to our next game. That's how they're getting people to attend these games, and these are some of the best female hockey players in the world. It's
right.
Criminal.
Well, so in your piece in the Globe magazine, you explore a lot of reasons why that might be, and we'll talk about some of them. But when you talked to the players and the coaches, say on the Blades team, why do they think they're not drawing that same passion and enthusiasm?
Because of the competition out there. I mean, because they cannot get a lot of exposure. When it's the Olympics, that's really the only thing that's going on in the sports world. When you're playing for the Blades, first of all, you're competing with the Boston Bruins. Your season runs along this at the same time as the Bruins. That's number one. But not only in this marketplace are you competing with the Bruins, you're also competing with the Patriots. typically through February. So that's most of the Blades season as well. And then you've also got the Celtics you're competing with. So there are at least three men's professional options that are taking fans away. And fans have a limited amount of money and time to spend on sports and going to games. And they're not going to games. And with the Blades in particular, they also had an arena that was about 30 miles outside of Boston.
So it wasn't even in Greater Boston.
Exactly. Yeah. So inconvenient to get to. They're hoping to draw more fans by relocating to UMass Boston for this season.
Right. So, I mean, Boston is one of those cities in the United States that has these big name, you know, top of league teams in the multiple men's leagues. But certainly this problem of the women's leagues not attracting enough enthusiasm, fan support, or financial support, which we'll talk about in a second, isn't unique to Boston, though.
No, it's not unique. I mean, I would say there are a couple of pockets throughout the country that are exceptions to the rule, but the rule generally is that women's teams draw poorly, lack sponsors, lack exposure, and Boston, even with all the competition, is not an exception.
So let's talk about the money for a second, because financing and support on that front can go a long way, because it pays for marketing, it pays players' salaries, it pays for venues, etc. Like, what are the differences in terms of what some of the men's leagues or men's professional teams get versus women's teams?
I think that the one that I mentioned in the article and the one that was most glaring to me was first that the Boston Breakers, the women's professional soccer team in Boston, has a total operating budget of $1.3 million per season. That covers everything from salaries to game night security for the team. To put that in perspective, a relief pitcher for the Red Sox, Junichi Suzawa, makes $1.3 million for this season alone. The Breakers have 7 full-time staff members. The Red Sox have 9 full-time staff members on their marketing staff alone. So you just begin to see the colossal difference between what the Red Sox can do with their money and their staffing and what the Breakers can do.
Is it really fair to make that kind of comparison, though, right? Because Major League Baseball has been around for so long. The Red Sox are one of the biggest teams in the league. I mean, women's soccer, while they've been playing for a couple generations seriously, the league itself is still pretty new. I mean, is it fair to make that comparison?
It's unfair to make that comparison, but unfortunately, it's the comparison you have to make, because that's who the Breakers are competing against, in the sense that when the Red Sox are playing and sports fans have a choice, let's go to a Red Sox game or let's go to a Breakers game. I don't know if that's the exact choice, but if they're thinking about how they want to spend their sports dollar, that's what the decision comes down to, because the Red Sox season, April through September, the Breakers season, April through August. So there is that competition, and if the Red Sox have that amount of money and staffing marketing them, and the Breakers don't, that's what you end up with.
So in your piece, you talk about the veritable alphabet soup of failed women's professional sports leagues. But you also spend a good period of time talking about one that's really bucked the trend, and that's the WNBA, for some really specific reasons which might serve as examples for other professional leagues. So tell us, just remind us briefly about how the WNBA was formed and what makes it different in terms of its relationship with the NBA, men's basketball.
Well, the WNBA was formed under the auspices of the NBA. The NBA gave the WNBA its full backing. They wanted a women's league. They saw it as a valuable business move, a strategic move, because they thought if they could get basketball in front of fans year-round, it would also generate interest in the men's game. And they also thought they needed extra programming for their various sports networks, the major sports networks year-round, so they thought women's basketball could do that. So they saw that women's basketball would make sense. So they backed it, they supported it, they marketed it, and they got it through some really tough times. And I talked to Commissioner David Stern, who was there for the launch and oversaw the launch of the league in 1997 when they played their first games. And he said that was the thinking. You know, we were going to be fully behind this league and we wanted it to succeed. And we knew we'd have to ride some ups and downs. Mm. And he called it the Big Brother scenario. And we found, or we can see across the country, that when male sports teams sort of adopt women's teams, they succeed. And so the WNBA is a case study in that, and there are other case studies in Portland where it's worked with that same method.
Portland in terms of soccer, women's
soccer,
and men's soccer, right? Because
yes.
It's the Timbers, the men's team, and the Thorn, or the women's team.
Correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that's one other example, but what about, say, in ice hockey or soccer beyond just in Portland, between men and women's soccer nationally? Are the men's leagues thinking, hey, let's follow the lead of the NBA and the WNBA and you know, do this big brother in the best sense of the term here to support women's sports?
Not on a league-wide basis, but on a team-by-team basis, you're starting to see men's teams say, you know what, this might be a good idea. Let's see what we can do here, because it makes business sense to them. It has to make more than, you know, it's not an act of charity. They don't want it to be perceived as an act of charity, but it has to make some business sense. So, for example, in Calgary, Alberta, the president of hockey operations for the Calgary Flames, the NHL team there, is sort of adopting the Inferno, which is the women's professional mm-hmm. hockey team there. And he's going to experiment this year. This is Brian Burke, the president of hockey operations. And Brian is going to experiment this year, possibly with some double headers with the men's and women's teams, maybe some practices where the media will be put in front of the women's team as well as the men's team. So, and you have to do that. Women's teams at this stage, with things so developed on the men's side, can't do it alone.
Yeah. So let's talk briefly about one issue which might rub a lot of people the wrong way, and that is the assumption that the women's game just isn't as compelling as the men's game, or that it's just different to watch and it doesn't excite hardcore sports fans as much as
so
the men's
I
game.
Disagree with the fact that it isn't as compelling. I think it
I'm
can
not saying this
be
is my
as,
opinion
I can't
by the way.
It can be as compelling, but I would agree with the fact that it is different. But different doesn't necessarily mean lesser. And it was interesting because for the article, I talked with the dean of MIT's Sloan School of Business, who's a marketing guru, David Schmittlein. And I said, you know, can you give me an example of a case where there was a product or a team or something that was perceived as inferior, but through marketing was able to change that perception and really excel in the marketplace? And he said, light beer. And he said it was perceived as inferior initially, but through a very skillful marketing campaign, tastes great, less filling, it took off. And he said that women's sports, women's professional sports in particular, have to think about what their distinctive value is, because they're superior in some way. They offer something that men's sports don't. But what is that? And they have to think about that. And once they figure that out, they have to market that.
Well, and once they do figure it out, I mean, you give an example of how there are some really successful women's professional teams. For example, the WNBA team that plays in Connecticut. They don't play in, you know, Connecticut's biggest cities, right? They play kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, Uncasville, Connecticut,
okay.
You could say.
Sorry, Uncasville. I didn't mean to call you the middle of nowhere, but.
You could say is a bit out there.
Yeah.
And that you're absolutely right. I believe they're about 45 miles from the nearest city, nearest major city. But they have been tremendously successful. And they're tremendously successful for a number of reasons. One of the key reasons is that they are not that far away from the 9-time national champion UConn
right.
Huskies. And what the UConn women Huskies have done, it has shown sports fans in Connecticut what women's basketball can be. And it has created an audience that appreciates women's basketball. And that translates to people appreciating what the Connecticut Sun bring to the court.
Well, so I'm wondering if that's actually a good model going forward, like that leagues or teams should pick places where the collegiate level of play for women is really high and there's that sort of built-in fan base already.
I think that is one model. Unfortunately, if you look at a lot of college campuses, you know, UConn is a rural campus. There are going to be successful teams in pockets that might not be in media centers and in metro centers. So I think it's good if a league has a mix of those Uncasville locations, but also some major metropolitan locations as well, because just the sheer number will get fans in, one would hope, eventually.
Right. So there's a chicken and egg problem here as well. But Shira, I mean, in the last minute that we have to go here, in your reporting and talking with people who are both, you know, management, coaches and players in a lot of these women's professional leagues, if you had to sort of pick a solution or the top two things that they should pursue to really help them grow, what would they be?
I think, a sound marketing strategy. I think they need to really, like David Schmidtline said, think about what gives them distinctive value and market them. And I think they also need to get away from marketing to young girls, and they have to look for a sustainable fan group, a fan group that's going to be very emotional and be passionate about them and not require their parents to drive them to games and to buy their tickets. They need independent fans who are passionate.
Well, Shira Springer is an investigative and enterprise reporter for the Boston Globe sports section. Her article, Why Do Fans Ignore Women's Pro Sports, is going to appear in this weekend's Globe magazine. There's a link to it at radioboston.org. Shira, it is always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk to a player who hasn't missed a Red Sox home game in 12 years. We're talking to Fenway Park's organist, Josh Cantor. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.